Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with my co-host, Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director of Food Safety Magazine.
Ta-da! Here I am.
Yay, there you are. Yes. And later, you'll hear Barbara's interview with Wendy White, a longtime friend of Food Safety Magazine. Wendy joins us today as a bit of a companion piece to her article in our April-May issue, which is entitled Best Practices for Virtual Communication. And the article discusses pivoting from traditional means of communication to ensure business continuity. And I think that we can all agree there's been a lot of learning over this last year and a half about virtual communication. And that's before we even get to the pivoting. I think that 2020 and 2021 has taken pivoting to a whole new level. That's right. Pivot! Pivot! How could I not? For anyone that does not immediately bring a smile, do yourself a favor, Google Friends Pivot. Or maybe you just need a laugh. You already know the bit. Go ahead, treat yourself, Friends Pivot. I'm sorry to digress, but it had to be done. You're going to want to stay tuned for to hear Barbara's discussion with Wendy about virtual learning and her role at Georgia Tech Extension. And now we're going to move on to a few tasty news bites. According to a new study in the International Journal of Systematic and Evolutionary Microbiology, Cornell researchers have found five previously unknown and novel kinds of Listeria. The discovery was made while examining the prevalence of Listeria in U.S. agricultural soil. The researchers say that identifying these novel species will help food facilities improve food safety by identifying potential growth niches that may have previously been overlooked. According to the researchers, understanding the different Listeria species is important for comprehending their similarities. In addition, the study will help the food industry become better at identifying L. monocytogenes and not misidentifying it as something else. In the study, the scientists collected soil and water samples from all over the United States, and they found 27 Listeria isolates that could not be classified to the species level. Whole genome sequencing showed that these new species formed five novel distinct clusters. Three of the five species were named to honor Listeria researchers, including L. farberi, for Jeff Farber, a microbiologist at the University of Guelph, and guest on our podcast for episode 49. How cool is that?
Now, if I'm just saying, I don't know how you'd pronounce that species, but it could be farberi. I don't
farberi?
Know. Farberi? Maybe. Oh. I don't know.
Maybe next time you talk to Jeff, he'll let you know exactly.
Yeah, when I grow up, I want to be a microbiologist and have and bacteria named after me. That would be cool.
It's pretty darn cool. So for those of you who would like to take a deeper dive on the study, there will, as always, be a link in the show notes. And moving on June 1st, FDA launched its new era of smarter food safety, low or no cost tech-enabled traceability challenge.
Sounds like a game show.
Doesn't it?
You know?
I know. I was trying to really sell it. The challenge. One of the foundational core elements of the new era of smarter food safety blueprint is tech-enabled traceability, the ability to quickly track a food throughout the food system from when it leaves its source to when it lands on consumers' plates. Achieving end-to-end food traceability will involve everyone in the supply chain, from source to table. And to achieve that level of participation, FDA needs accessible tracing solutions for human and animal food companies of all sizes. This will help ensure that even small companies can use and benefit from new tracing technologies. The challenge, we should have music like challenge me. The challenge The challenge asks stakeholders, including technology providers, entrepreneurs, and innovators, to develop traceability tools that can be implemented in a scalable, cost-effective way for food operations of all sizes. So there's a pre-registration webpage with all the information needed to participate in the challenge until the submission window closes on July 30th at 5 p.m. So set your timers, 5 p.m. Eastern. Up to 12 winners will be announced at the completion of the competition.
Do they give a prize?
There is no cash prize. They say that that notability, you know, there will certainly be press. So they're in it for the notoriety, for the attention, you know?
That's still cool.
That's cool.
That's cool.
That's cool. Yeah. See, our news was all cool stuff today. So fun. There you go. All right. So as always, we'll provide links to all the resources that we mentioned in our show notes. You can find them in your podcast player or on our website at food-safety.com. Find episode 97. And one last thing, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Just search for Food Safety Magazine. And now, without apparently any ado whatsoever, none, zero ado, it's time for Barbara's discussion with Wendy White, Industry Manager for Food and Beverage for Georgia Tech's Georgia Manufacturing Extension Program. I'm not going to get involved in the acronym for that. So, no, I'll save you all. No acronyms. Where she serves as the food safety expert to Georgia food businesses by providing educational outreach and aiding the improvement of food safety and quality systems. Before joining academia in 2019, Wendy spent the first 17 years of her career in food manufacturing and distribution, most recently as a corporate director of food safety and quality for Golden State Foods. Wendy received her BS in biology at the University of Georgia and stayed to complete her MS in food science under the tutelage of the renowned and Food Safety Magazine Distinguished Service Award winner, Dr. Larry Bouchat. She has been a member of IAFP since 2001 and has been deeply involved with many professional development groups over the years. In 2011, she was honored to receive the IAFP President's Recognition Award from Dr. Leanne Jacus. Wendy has presented at many industry conferences over the years and has published articles in the Journal of Food Protection and Food Safety Magazine, among others. And most important, or I should say, and most important, she currently serves on the editorial advisory board of Food Safety Magazine.
You know, I always love talking to Wendy, but she gives a lot of tips for how to engage people during these virtual courses and trainings that she conducts. And telling relatable stories was my favorite tip. And I bet these would work during some of our virtual meetings. So I might try some of those once in
a while. So Barbara's taking notes during her interview. There you go.
There you go.
So good. Words to learn by.
There you go.
Coming up very quickly from Barbara and Wendy White. So stay tuned for that discussion.
Hi, Wendy. It's great to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks, Barbara. It's a joy to be here.
I've been looking forward to talking with you about the advantages and disadvantage or challenges of virtual learning, especially in light of your article that came out in the April-May 2021 issue of Food Safety Magazine with Jennifer Stone on this very topic. So let's get started. I want to start with kind of setting the stage for our listeners. Your focus at Georgia Tech is on professional educational outreach and support to help food manufacturers and their food safety and quality systems. Can you describe for our listeners like what a typical day for you looks like?
Yeah, a lot of people aren't familiar with my particular organization. The Georgia Manufacturing Extension Partnership is actually a state affiliate chapter of a larger parent organization, which is the Manufacturing Extension Partnership National Network. And our mission is to help food and beverage manufacturers across the country. And so I'm part of the extension branch of the university. And so we deliver continuous professional education. We do one-on-one client services, and often those are subsidized by the state and federal. So they tend to be a little bit more affordable, and we like to focus on small and medium-sized manufacturers.
Now, do you offer specific courses? How does the education get brought to the manufacturer, for example?
Right. We host a variety of educational opportunities. We do open enrollment classes, so periodic scheduled classes throughout the year. I am chiefly focused on the food and beverage industries, but my department as a whole focuses on all manufacturing. So anything from machine shops to automotive. And so inside of the food industry umbrella, we offer PCQI certification classes, HACCP classes, GMPs, kind of your normal food safety classes, in addition to my coworkers that do, you know, Lean Six Sigma, OSHA, leadership classes and things like that.
So the classes, you could have people from multiple companies, you know, joining in on a class, right?
Absolutely. We do both. We do open enrollment cohort type of classes where we kind of learn together and pull from different experiences through multiple companies. And then we also do some private trainings as well.
So when it is safe for you to go out into plants, you could be called upon to say, we're having issues with X, Y, or Z, and you can come in and help them, kind of walk them through their process and maybe give them some suggestions what might be going on.
Yeah, that's an important part of what we do. You know, whatever the manufacturer needs help with, you know, if they need support, oftentimes connecting with another resource. So they're looking for a packaging supplier and we kind of help them find that, connect them with other companies and other organizations. Maybe they're having a hard time complying to a governmental regulation. And so we can offer support there, or we can come on site. You know, maybe they have problems with their infrastructure, putting in a new piece of equipment, something like that. After all, Georgia Tech is an engineering school, so we have plenty of engineers that can come and help out with that type of thing.
That's great. So you could bill yourself out as like the matchmaking group, right? Hooking different groups up together to, you know, the packaging supplier with the manufacturer. So,
yeah, we have a lot of connections within the industry. And so we do a lot of that connecting manufacturing companies with different resources. You know, maybe they're looking for a way to conduct automatic traceability. You know, maybe they're looking for a leadership training. Maybe they're looking for, like I said, a supplier or an alternative vendor. Yeah, we can definitely help with those kinds of things.
Oh, that's great. So before you joined Georgia Tech, you were with Golden State Foods. How difficult a transition was it for you to move from kind of corporate America to an academic position?
Yeah, you know, Barbara, you get pretty comfortable and confident in your professional skills when you've been in the industry for 17 years. And I didn't quite realize what a role reversal is going to be. And so, you know, there are pros and cons to every, you know, sector of our industry. But moving to academia was definitely different. You know, I think that the work-life balance is a little easier, which is really, really nice. But I kind of miss the hustle and bustle of being in the plant. And, you know, it's funny because there's a new set of skills that I had to learn. I actually submitted my first grant earlier this year. And so that was a skill I never had, because most people learn that in their postdoc in their first couple years at university. So it was quite an experience learning something totally from scratch.
So was there anything that you had to make sure was put in place to kind of aid in this transition? Any tips you can give to people who might find themselves, you know, making such a dramatic career shift?
Well, I was really fortunate that I have a lot of friends and close colleagues in academia. And so, you know, the first thing I did was reach out to those people and just ask their advice, you know, trying to figure out what the expectations were going to be, what resources were out there for my new role, and, you know, ways that I could add value to the companies that I was going to serve.
So, obviously, with the pandemic, you've had to shift all of the in-person courses and going into plants with a virtual format. So what was the transition like to do that?
With every single school, university, you know, educational organization, we had to switch, and it seemed like it was literally overnight. I was actually in the middle of a multi-day workshop when we decided, you know, it was not safe anymore and we wanted to switch to virtual. So I only had a few days to scramble and get my ducks in a row. You know, I was really lucky that I had very strong support staff. Jennifer Stone, who you mentioned before, was my co-author on our recent article. She's our instructional designer. And so she was hugely helpful in switching that from on-site to virtual. And it was a lot of trial and error. You know, we had to try out a couple things. Some things worked beautifully, some things not so well. And so, you know, we've really strove towards continuous improvement to make ourselves more effective virtual educators.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine for some of the coursework, it was, you know, once you got used to the platforms that you're using, that it would be fairly straightforward. And having two kids in college, I've kind of gotten the impression that it's gotten easier and better over time. But are there practical types of things that you just can't do virtually? And I guess I'm thinking, if you're going into a plant and you're looking at a line and you're actually physically there to make observations, that some of that would be a lot more difficult to do if you're just being told about it by the people who were there.
Right. Really, I found that there's two different facets of trainings that they're very hard to teach virtually. The first is very technical, very complex subjects. So things like hazard analysis. And it's one thing if you're giving a QA manager a refresher training. It's quite another if you're training maybe the owner of a startup who's never even heard of HACCP before. And that can be very, very difficult to do in a virtual setting. You know, I think the second is when you have topics that really require or are much better taught in a tactical standpoint. So things like sanitation, you know, you can teach the concepts virtually, but that really doesn't take the place of going in the plant with a student and doing it. You know, the things that you need to learn by doing, those are a little bit harder and I don't think is effective in a virtual setting.
Have you encountered students of yours who just can't seem to learn virtually, that they really need that hands-on experience?
You know, as I was saying, I think it's a struggle for the smaller companies. It's a struggle for the professionals that aren't necessarily focused or don't have a strong background in food safety. And so for them, virtual is a little bit of a struggle. And what we did to combat this is we started offering workshops with a one-on-one coaching component. And so that cohort model really has been effective where I can give a virtual lecture to a class of a couple different companies, but then we schedule one-on-one calls where we can go through a company by company solo and say, okay, now what are you having a problem with? Have you tried to apply this to your company? You know, what challenges are you encountering? You know, what can I offer to kind of subsidize, to support that training?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that's a really nice thing that you can offer to kind of tailor it for that group. Let them take what they learned initially in your course and go back and try and put it into practice and then be able to follow up with them. So do you have any tips for our listeners out there who have had to do a lot of things virtually that you have found work really well to boost engagement?
Yes, engagement in a virtual platform is probably the most challenging piece of it. You know, I've found that the more different opportunities you give students to participate, the better. So, you know, giving them the option to unmute and verbally answer, answer in the chat, even annotate and write on the slide. If you're doing a, like a multiple choice question or circle the problem in the slide in this picture, you know, the variety really, really helps. I've also found that the video cameras, having the video cameras on does help. When you can look somebody in the eye, even if it's virtually, that tends to focus people's attention a little bit more. And I also think that being well prepared so that you can combat technical difficulties that arise or distractions, you know, quick with the mute button, that really does go a long way in minimizing those tiny little disruptions and tends to focus people a lot better.
So I'm going to ask you if you have any interesting stories, maybe things that happened that you didn't expect, things that you thought would work really well that didn't, or things that you were unsure about that were really home runs in terms of training. Anything you can share?
Yeah, I'll start with my big mistake. So lesson learned. So last spring, I was very clever and thought, you know, if I had a bigger class, it'll actually spur engagement because, you know, more people, more engagement. And that was incorrect assumption on my part, because I think people were a little bit intimidated by the number. So I had like a class of 45 people, and it was a multi-day workshop, and the first class was like crickets. It was so hard to kind of pull people out of their shell. And I decided it went so poorly that I decided just to split up the class. And so we had like a Monday class and a Tuesday class, identical classes. So it was split into like 22 people each. And it was totally different experience. And so I think that, yeah, cutting that class size, that was a huge lesson learned. You know, the smaller the class, it tends to be a little bit better because I think people, they're not as intimidated by that number.
Well, I think it's easy just as being part of different virtual meetings. You can kind of make yourself invisible if you need to when there are a lot of people. And it's a lot harder to do that when the numbers are obviously lower. Tell me a little bit about how you do assessments in a virtual course. And, you know, with the camera on, you can get an impression, I think, in terms of eye contact, body language, if you really have, you know, the attention of your students, but how do you, you know, assess someone's understanding of what you're teaching?
Yeah, assessing knowledge retention is definitely a challenge in a virtual setting. What I like to do is I like to have a few slides that are dispersed throughout my lecture that have, you know, questions. And so I tend to refer to it as trivia to kind of relieve a little of the pressure. But I usually have a roster of my students and I kind of keep an informal track of who's answering what question. Are they answering it right? To try to kind of figure out the folks that are really catching on and maybe the people that need a little bit more attention and a little bit more effort to draw them out of their shell and get them to participate.
Mm-hmm. So you referenced the number of years that you've spent previously in the manufacturing space, food manufacturing. Maybe you can share how that background has shaped your teaching approach.
Yeah, you know, as a professional in the manufacturing industry, I didn't quite realize how much of a trainer I was. You know, I trained constantly throughout my career, and that really all of that experience really helped me when I was in a formal classroom setting. But I found that it was my personal experience that really added to my value as an instructor. Being able to tell those real world stories and share case studies is a really effective means of helping those professionals understand the topics and help them brainstorm for solutions to their own challenges. And another avenue I've found is that, you know, being a good educator is closely related to being a good storyteller. Sharing those entertaining stories is really one of the best engagement techniques I have. Because once you've captured their interest, it's a lot easier to get them to understand the topics that you're trying to disseminate. And I really can't tell you how satisfying it is to have a student or a client that has a problem. And because I've dealt with a similar situation, I can offer them potential solutions.
So with some of the classes that you offer consistently, do you have like the story that you keep ready for a HACCP class, for example? Do you have some examples that you could share with our listeners?
Certainly. Too many examples to list. You know, I think any food safety practitioner has come across some wacky situations. One that I often talk about is the fact that I was doing some corporate auditing at one of our facilities, we're in the conference room, we're getting ready to dive into the HACCP plans. It's the very beginning of the assessment, and the fire alarm goes off. And of course, me, like every other American, thinks it's a drill. And so I reluctantly let them drag me out of the conference room, and we're outside, you know, mustering with everybody else. And then I see the fire trucks, and I was like, oh my, and then I see smoke. And I realized, oh my Lord, it's a real fire. And so they looked at me, like the plant manager came up to me and he said, who at corporate do we need to notify right now? And I thought to myself, who at corporate do we need to? And I had to like boot up my laptop and like dig through my files and get the crisis management, you know, plan out. And I realized that we needed to simplify this because in an actual crisis, you know, your priorities are different than what you have planned. And the simpler, the better. And so we really took that opportunity to enhance that program and make it a lot better.
That's a great story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that, if nothing else, having to really pivot quickly, you know, that the food industry really had to pivot quickly for the pandemic. I think a lot of those learnings, came home very quickly, right? Not only supply chain and just in time and different suppliers and, you know, all of that people. It was complicated before, and maybe in some ways not complicated enough. If you were relying on a single supplier at the start of the pandemic, and then you realize that's not going to work, simplifying for accounting purposes maybe is not the right way to go. So there are a lot of things that have had to change. But I think in something so time sensitive as, you know, a fire or a storm or something like that, I think it's good to have some, what am I trying to say? Drew, I'm going to rephrase that last little bit. I think that when you're trying to adapt to something very time sensitive, like a fire or a storm, you really need to have that on the tip of your tongue. Everyone needs to know who the go-to person is and the main contact. So if we go back to some of the stories that you're sharing with your students, what's your impression of what you're able to share with them is the most meaningful? Have you had feedback from the students that they really appreciate that you're not just someone who can teach material without any real world experience? Do you think that is what kind of sets you apart in this role?
I really think so. You know, I've had a lot of very positive feedback and a lot of appreciation. You know, I think that it takes a little bit of bravery to share mistakes with people. And I've learned that. I have a lot of admiration for companies like Maple Leaf Foods, Jack in the Box, that have shared their mistakes so openly with the community and said, hey, here's what we did we shouldn't have done, but here's what we did to make it better. Here's what we did to fix it. And I think that is such a tremendous amount of value. And so I really tried to take the spirit of that and apply it to my instruction.
Sure. You bring up Maple Leaf. That's a perfect example of a company that was exceeding regulatory requirements at the time, right? They were doing everything right. They were going above and beyond what was required, and they still had a problem. So that kind of puts a little bit of spin on all the preventive actions that people should be taking in the plant. I asked you about a HACCP story, but are there other examples that you're able to share with your classes to really drive home how they need to be thinking, maybe in new ways, about the processes going on in the plant and what they should be doing?
Right. Because I have such a long history in the manufacturing sector, I tend to have a very realistic approach to regulatory compliance and setting up food safety and quality systems. So I tend to focus on the requirements first and then build on that to elevate your food safety plans to incorporate the best practices and meet the expectations of discerning customers, GFSI standards, and things like that. Because I think, especially with small and medium companies, you don't need to overwhelm them with everything, the perfect plan. Show them the basics, show them the simple steps, and then work into elevating up to the best practices.
Now, when you have these smaller classes, have you been able to encourage, when someone asks a question, to kind of open it up to the class to brainstorm some answers or what they would do in a certain situation?
Absolutely. You know, I think that as you feel, as you go along in your class and everybody starts to feel more comfortable with each other, especially if you're fortunate enough to have a multi-day class, then people loosen up and they tend to share stories. And I think that, you know, other companies' stories are just as valuable as my own. And so I think that once, you know, companies see that other people are having the same exact problems that they're having and they're able to network a little bit, I think it adds a tremendous amount of value to the session.
I would think that would be one of the advantages of this type of, you know, teaching platform, the virtual platform, is that you're able to get people from, you know, different parts of the world or parts of the country who might not normally sit in on a class or workshop together. Can you describe some other advantages that you've kind of discovered by the, you know, need to shift to virtual instruction?
Absolutely. You know, we tend to focus on the disadvantages and the challenges of virtual education, and don't get me wrong, they're there, but there's some amazing advantages too. And I think that it's only by experiencing this last year that we're really starting to appreciate some of the benefits of virtual education. You know, you mentioned the concept that travel is no longer an issue. So, you know, if I have a client that is desperate need of a HACCP class, you know, I can go to my sister organization in Iowa because she's teaching a virtual HACCP class in 2 weeks, and you know, my Georgia company can take her class just as easy as they could take one from me. Also, it tends to be more economic. And so you're able to lower the cost of your class, which definitely is important to small and medium companies. And then I think that you can have, you know, a bigger variety of participation. Recently, I was talking to David Tharp from the International Association of Food Protection. And he was telling me about the webinars that IAFP has had over the last year. And the surprising thing that they found when they looked at the data was how many food safety professionals from developing countries were participating in these webinars. You know, the outpouring of participation was just unprecedented. So they were, you know, they would have 1,000 people, you know, attend a webinar, which they'd never had before. And then when they looked at what countries they were from, they were really blown away by how many countries we've never had participation from, because, you know, as people get used to the virtual format and interacting on that level, you know, I think you're going to see more and more of that, which is just a wonderful thing.
Right. And just kind of a side note with the podcast, you know, if it's 3 or 4 years, we're having a debate on how long we've been doing this. It's felt like a long time. We're always surprised by the reach of it across the world, that we have folks who, you know, have subscribed to the podcast and send us notes from all areas of the world. So it is really an advantage to try and reach as many people as we can. So in the context of presenting these courses and interacting with a lot of different people, what can you say personally that you've taken away from this experience, and what, give us a couple things that you've learned throughout the process?
You know, I think that through trial and error, through networking with my colleagues, I've learned a lot of best practices to make myself more effective as a virtual instructor. You know, I've really learned the advantages that remote education has. You know, and I think it's really cemented its place in the world of professional continuous education. You know, I think that there is definitely a place for it in the future. You know, as the classrooms, the students in grade school and university, as they head back to the classrooms, Georgia Tech's planning on having on-site classes as normal in the fall. Fingers crossed, we'll see. You know, I think that the virtual classroom for professional educators is going to be here to stay. I think we'll definitely go back to some on-site learning, especially for those complex topics like HACCP, food safety plans. But some topics that aren't that complex, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to give your classes virtually.
So what are some of those classes that you think could be done 100% on a computer platform?
No, I think good manufacturing practices, that's pretty easy to disseminate verbally, remotely. Food allergens, kind of some of your basic prerequisite classes, I think lend themselves very well to a virtual format where you can have, you know, a slide deck, some videos, and just have that that interaction, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in a classroom.
So, Wendy, as we wrap up, what is your hope for the coming year as we are moving out of the, hopefully moving out of the pandemic?
Well, you know, one of the things that's just profoundly impressed me is the adaptability of the food industry. You know, you think of what our industry has accomplished over the past year and a half, it's quite amazing, because when things were shutting down, when people were quarantining, you know, the plants were open business as usual. And the mitigation strategies, the protection strategies that they put in place at a drop of a hat was just amazing. And of course, you know, we had some sporadic grocery store shortages here and there. But if you think about how complex the supply chain is and how many different pieces are vital to making it work, it was just really amazing that we were able to carry on and really not have that, not have a tragic impact to our supply chain. And so, I mean, I know this industry, and we're going to use all of those lessons learned, and we're going to apply them to make the supply chain even stronger, you know, to make our employees, our customers, our products safer, and really use those best practices going forward.
So with those views for the near future, Any plans to offer some additional classes that maybe wouldn't have been as relevant pre-pandemic?
Yeah, I think that there is going to be a focus on supply chain management that wasn't there before. You know, I think a lot of manufacturing companies that were utilizing the just-in-time inventory method, which makes a lot of sense, that's a little more risky when you have when you start having some scarcity and supply issues. So I think that, you know, you're going to see a focus on how to make those more robust. You know, I think that you're going to see a resurgence of focus on automation and ways that you can help, because we had a lot of shortages in the workforce, and which really, really hurt the manufacturing industry quite a lot. So I think you'll see a renewed interest in that, as well as automated systems. You know, how can we use data to, you know, make our processes more efficient and run better?
Well, that makes all the engineering students at Georgia Tech very happy, that focus on automation. So do you have other thoughts about how we're coming out of the pandemic in terms of where we've been before?
Well, you know, as we were talking, I was thinking of how interesting it is that, you know, in the 90s, we had an information renaissance. And so the concept of global information sharing, you know, came to the forefront. And I think with the pandemic, we're seeing the beginnings of a communication renaissance, where we'll have true global communication. And we're only going to see that flourish, I think, from here.
Well, Wendy, it's been so delightful to see you, although on the screen. It'll be nice to be back in person at some point and to have you on the podcast. And we will put a link to your article along with Jennifer in the show notes for your podcast episode.
Thanks so much, Barbara. This was so much fun. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Wendy White for joining us on the podcast today. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. You'll find links to all the references that we mentioned in the episode in our show notes. You can access those on your podcast player or on our website at food-safety.com. Hit the podcast tab in the top navigation and then find episode 97. Don't ever, ever, ever hesitate. Send us your questions and suggestions to podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. You can make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your podcast player by clicking that subscribe button. And while you're there, please take a moment and rate the podcast. You know, throw some stars our way. It's good for everyone. All right, that's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on June 22nd. Take good care of yourselves and those around you. We'll talk to you then.